Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our studios here in Tower Bridge. I'm Mala Shakulon, and I run EY UK's corporate governance team. In this role, I support companies and boards in achieving good governance. With me here is Elizabeth Bagger from the Institute for Family Business and James Waits. We're going to have a short and sharp discussion, hopefully a few minutes of your time well spent on the topic of private company governance, which I've been having many discussions on recently. James, Elizabeth, welcome. Do you want to say a few words about yourselves?
Thank you, Mala. Yeah.
Thank you.
James Waits. I'm chairman of the Waits Group, a privately owned 120-year-old fourth generation family business. We are probably one of the biggest privately held construction, development and property services companies in the country.
And I'm the Director General of the Institute for Family Business, and we're a membership organisation and a trade association that supports UK-based family businesses.
Welcome to both of you again. Just before we get into our discussion, I just want to do a quick refresher of some of the recent developments in this area. Private company governance isn't a topic that we've discussed traditionally in the governance remit. Governance has been largely limited to listed companies. Yet, following some government consultations and parliamentary inquiries in late 2016, there were calls for more accountability in the governance of private companies, largely in response to some of the well-publicised failings of some private companies. So a quick recap. The government introduced new legislation, the Companies Miscellaneous Reporting Regulations, which requires large private companies meeting certain size thresholds to report on their governance arrangements. To help companies apply these new regulations, the government appointed James Waits to lead a coalition to develop a new set of governance principles that were more proportionate for private companies. There are other requirements for companies too, around stakeholder engagement, employee engagement, and a need to make a statement on their Section 172 duties. We won't go into these today, but the reason I'm emphasising them is because there's quite a few interdependencies between the corporate governance statement and these other requirements, particularly around employee engagement and stakeholder engagement. James, I just want to reflect a little bit on the focus on governance in private companies. I mean, traditionally, this hasn't been a subject of debate in the governance sphere, because unlike public companies where there's a separation of ownership and control, there isn't that same issue for private companies. And some might say, well, then what's the issue and why bother?
It's a good question, Mala. I think the reality is, as well, any business who believes in wealth creation, I think you have a responsibility to operate in a way that is visible and transparent. From the Waits point of view, for a long time, we have reported as if we were a PLC. So when we had the opportunity to get involved with this initiative to actually shape something around private businesses, because they are different, because as you rightly say, private businesses, the ownership tends to be much closer to what's going on than they are in the PLC world. I think there's a great opportunity to explain what you're about, how you do it, and therefore create a connection with the society that we operate in. Because as businesses, we have a license to operate, which is limited liability status. There has always been a connection between shareholders and business. And I think a lot of people have sort of been totally focused on that. Mm-hmm. The reality is, to operate effectively, in my view, you have to take cognizance of all your stakeholders. And that is your workforce, it's the society you operate in, it's your customers, it's your supply chain, and your shareholders. And I think getting the balance right across all your stakeholder group is critically important if you are to be a long-term successful business.
Private companies can choose the Waits principles as a code or as a framework to comply with the new legislative requirements. So a question for both of you. What changes do you think the Waits principles bring about?
I think that this is a great opportunity for private businesses to have a conversation internally about how they wish to apply the principles. The beauty of these principles is that they are quite flexible, they're quite high level, and that means that they are open to real engagement and conversation inside of the businesses.
I mean, as Elizabeth said, you know, they are high level. But in our view, the view of the coalition, and indeed myself, it's actually what good businesses do. If you are a good business, you would be adopting the principles that are articulated here anyway. All we've done is put them into a structure that people can easily understand, can actually, as Elizabeth said, talk around and actually articulate what they do in response to these effective good governance levers.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. I think reading the principles, there is nothing you can fundamentally disagree with. They're just good common sense principles. So, and then that kind of moves me on to the next question. I think private companies is such a broad church. There are so many varying ownership structures. And importantly, the legislative requirements don't exempt wholly owned subsidiaries who meet the thresholds from applying the principles. How do you see this working? Because, you know, there's different varying, there are different ownership structures, different types of companies, and different governance arrangements that might apply in those companies. So how do you see that working in practice?
I think people will look at the principles and say, actually, these make sense. So let's use those as the framework for articulating what we do in governance to comply with the legislation. Now, it's not written in the legislation that you will use the weights principles. They are a set of principles that people can take on board that is in a clear framework that allows people, as I said earlier, to have that conversation about how they govern their business, to then promote their business around that. It's an opportunity for businesses to hold up a mirror to themselves, to actually look at how they're performing, look at what they're doing, and ask themselves perhaps some difficult questions. You know, what is our purpose? You know, how do we lead the business? What is our board structure? You know, how are we effective as a board? You know, what do we do about remuneration? Is it fair? Do we take cognizance of the wider stakeholder group, or is it just about the executives? It's asking those sort of questions and then responding to them in a, you know, in a governance report as part of the director's report. But then people can say, actually, I like the look of that business. That makes sense. That's a business that I want to do business with.
James, in your response there, you touched on an important point, purpose. And I think even in the conversations I have in the listed company world, purpose is quite a thought-provoking concept. And, you know, your principles state that the board is responsible for developing and promoting a purpose. What does purpose actually mean in your mind?
Well, if you take a very, very narrow view on it, which historically some people might have taken, is it's all about making money. Actually, no, it's not. Purpose is articulating, so what are we here for? And I think the way you articulate your purpose is very much around understanding the impact you have through what you do on the world in which you operate.
Mm-hmm. And the other discussion I have with some companies is, yes, it's fine for a company of your type who's building community infrastructure, assets, roads, etc. It's easier for them to have a purpose. Whereas if you're a bank or in financial services, it's actually harder to come up with a purpose. What's your view on that?
I think that's a cop out. I think if you set out and say, well, we don't have to have a purpose because we're in financial services, well, I think you've missed the boat.
Yeah.
You've actually got to understand that you do have a purpose. But what you've got to do is think about it and articulate it. And as a board, you've got to sort of peel back the layers and say, so what are we really here for? And if you are there purely to make money for the shareholders, then maybe that is your purpose. That might not be a purpose that the people you do business with actually want to support.
Yeah. I mean, reflections, Elizabeth, is purpose and profit, are they at odds with each other? Can you be profit-seeking, making, and have a purpose?
I believe that you can, and that we see that in many of our member businesses. There is immense power in being clear about your purpose, and it's the great opportunity for speaking primarily on behalf of family businesses at the moment, for family businesses to family owners to come together and clarify, why are we in business together? And we see that when they do that, they unlock new power and commitments, not just in the ownership group, but also as a business. And we hear some lovely stories about family businesses who put purpose before profit and actually end up being more profitable as a result.
Yeah, great point. So another interesting area is stakeholder engagement. And your principles state that the board is responsible for overseeing meaningful engagement with stakeholders. What do you think companies can actually do to achieve meaningful engagement? What does meaningful actually mean?
How do you engage with your workforce? Do you just send them a letter once a year saying Happy Christmas? Or do you actually do staff surveys and respond to them, ask the right questions, get the feedback from those questions, be seen to engage with your workforce through the way you respond to the questions that are asked, the challenges that are put. And I think as a board, you have to step up to that. We're a fourth generation business, as I said earlier, but we've got multi-generations of employees. So we've got people working for us today whose grandfather used to work for us. You know, we have a 25 club, people who've worked for the company for more than 25 years, over 300 members. And that's a lovely thing to have. And you don't have that if you don't engage with your staff. And yeah, one of the best days of our year, so that's certainly my point of view, is our annual 25 club lunch, when I see all of these people that have given a huge proportion of their working life to working in our business with us. And that's just a fantastic day. And that's, yeah, a very simple level of engagement. Similarly, I think with supply chain, you know, at Waits, we do engage very heavily with our supply chain. We think they're a critically important component of what we do. Without them, we would not be the successful company we are. So we spend time with our supply chain. We understand them deeply. We try and work hard with them to give them good opportunity to be profitable. And that, in turn, allows us to do good business. I think you take that into your client engagement. Very important to understand what your clients want. I remember the sort of PAT definition of marketing is the identification and satisfaction of customer need at a profit. If you don't understand what your customer wants, you cannot deliver it. And therefore, how can you make a profit? So stakeholder engagement is multifaceted. And I think what we're trying to do with these principles is say, talk about it, understand it, peel back the layers, and then go forward on it and say what you're doing. Because then people say, actually, that's, again, the sort of company that we want to do business with.
James, how do you see reporting working? You know, companies have another 8-9 months to think about the reporting because it's December 2019 year ends. But how do you see reporting working in practice?
I think you can make it very difficult and very complicated or very simple. And the way to make it simple is just to, as a board, at each board meeting, through the course of the year, just reflect on, so what do we talk about today that actually is relative to the Waits principles? And on the way through, you capture it. And at the end of the year, you actually got all the raw material to actually give a really powerful, concise corporate governance report that responds to the principles. And I think the alternative is you don't do anything for the year. You come to it in December, scratch your head and say, oh my goodness, we've got a report on our governance. How on earth are we going to do it? You know, where's our evidence? What are we going to talk about? You can do it simply or you can make it difficult. And I'd certainly advocate making it simple.
And who do you see leading this work? Who is, in your view, responsible for all of this work?
Ultimately, the chairman has to be responsible because the chairman runs the board. So you know, in our business, people look at me. But the good news is, I think we've got a very good company secretary who takes the notes and we'll ask the right questions to ensure that we're capturing the stuff on the way through. But ultimately, it's how you set the agenda. It's how you have the right discussions around the key parts of the principles.
And also what I've seen examples of is where the next generation have taken an interest in this area and have wanted to engage with the business. So it has become a multi-generational or intergenerational conversation in some of our member companies. And that was obviously not something that was thought of in advance, but when we heard it, we thought that makes such sense.
That's fascinating, actually, because a lot of this is about, you know, whether you're in a family business or any business really is kind of leaving a legacy, leaving the business in a better place than you found it.
The focus on that sustainable value creation has immense value, not just for the business itself, but also society at large. And that's one of the things that I think really makes family businesses stand out as quite unique and something that other businesses could potentially also be inspired by, that long-term thinking, that long-term sustainable value creation.
Long-term value creation is something we've been thinking really hard at EY about as well. Through our involvement with the Embankment Project on Inclusive Capitalism. We've developed a framework that companies can use in this area to articulate how they create value sustainably for the long term for all their stakeholders, and also a set of metrics that companies can use to actually measure in these various areas, so be it culture, values, governance, the metrics that actually matter the most and will help companies safeguard the assets that matter the most. So James, we're sort of at the start of a journey. The principles got issued in December 2018. How do you think these principles will evolve, and what's your vision for these principles?
I think these principles are a starting point. I don't say that we've come up with the perfect solution. I think we've come up with a very, very good starting point that will allow the conversations to continue to develop and evolve.
Stewardship is the other side of the corporate governance coin. So to actually, in the listed company world, there are shareholders who actually then, monitor and check what boards are doing and actually hold boards to account. In this scenario, private companies, we already talked about this, there isn't much separation, ownership and control. Who is going to monitor this? And I think when these, when the government was looking at putting frameworks around private company governance, there was some skepticism because they were saying, well, whose benefit is this all for? Who's going to check all this? Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the monitoring of this is going to be very important. And how we do it is under review because obviously the FRC have had the Kingman report that has changed or is suggesting a change to their the way they operate. But my understanding is, and certainly the coalition's preference, is the FRC have a strong role in continuing to monitor around this. Ultimately, if the reporting comes through and it's done in a clear and concise way, the best judge is going to be the court of public opinion. But I think the measurement of it will, how we do that will develop over time. I think it'll take two or three turns of the wheel, probably, before people actually start to get comfortable with what the principles mean and how they report against them. Mm-hmm. And then you'll start to see trends.
And I think given our recent, there's been a whole raft of recent regulations. If you take the Modern Slavery Act, if you take gender pay gap, supplier payment practices, I think in some way, many people are critical of throwing extra things into reports. But I genuinely believe those have changed behaviors and thinking in boardrooms. People are actually looking at the statistics and saying, well, why are we paying suppliers this late? Or why are our female staff paid this much less than our male staff? Or why don't we have female staff at the top of the organization? So I think, to me, that in itself is a success. So yes, you've got a report and you might sort of question who reads it, but it's led you to have different conversations in the boardroom.
Treat this as an opportunity to interrogate how you go about your business, to use the principles in a structured way to have the conversations that you need to have to be a better business.
Well, thank you so much to both of you for sharing your insights and, spending some time with us. Hopefully, for those of you listening, you got a lot of helpful tips from James and Elizabeth on how you can go about applying the principles, but also what they mean in the business context and why there's so much benefit in applying good governance. I think reporting is an outcome, and we will see reporting for years commencing on or after 1st January 2019 come through early in 2020. And as I said at the start, it's important that companies who are under the thresholds also look at the other aspects, so stakeholder engagement, employee engagement, and their Section 172 reporting. So, there is a little bit of devil in the detail, and make sure you read the regulations. Just before we sign out, just to signpost, we have some face-to-face events coming up. Again, James Waits has kindly agreed to host a discussion and a Q&A session. So if you go to our website, which is ey.com/corporate-governance, you'll find more details of these. And I hope you found that useful. And thank you again to James and Elizabeth for being here and sharing your insights with us.
Thank you.